Hello, and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. We've once again hit the season when families here and across the nation gather around the dinner table to break bread and count their blessings. For many, the holiday provides a welcome break from the bustle of daily life and a rare opportunity to reflect on how circumstance may be treating us well. But research in the field of positive psychology suggests we all might benefit from being more grateful in our everyday lives. Studies looking at the effects of gratitude have associated it with greater life satisfaction, a more positive outlook, improved health outcomes, and even better sleep patterns. So what does it mean to be truly grateful in the modern world? How does one cultivate a thankful outlook? And why do expressions of gratitude even matter? Our guests today come at these questions from very different directions, and we are thankful to them for joining us in today's conversation. First, Sharon Dunsky Vermont is a mother of two and a part-time pediatrician. For more than 4 months, she engaged in a gratitude experiment in order to teach her children to value what they have. She's currently working to publish a book about the experience. Welcome to the program, Sharon Dunsky Vermont.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for driving in from Chesterfield for our conversation today.
It's a nice two-hour drive.
Glad it went smoothly.
Yeah.
Also with us today, Robert Johnson is a professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri. He specializes in ethical theory and spends much of his academic time contemplating the virtues like gratitude and their origins. Welcome, Robert Johnson, to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. And we also have with us at the table today, John Battaglia. He is the lead pastor of the Christian Chapel Church in Columbia, where he's been for the past 5 years. Welcome to the program, John Battaglia.
Thanks so much.
And we hope that you in our audience will join our conversation as well. What are you grateful for? And what are some of the ways that you give thanks? Give us a call. Share your thoughts. 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's go ahead and start with you, Sharon. Tell us about your gratitude experiment.
Well, about a year and a half ago, when my two daughters were 10 and 8, my husband and I had been thinking that maybe giving them, you know, everything they were asking for was not a good idea. We were doing it because we loved our kids. We wanted to give them what we could. But we noticed that they were asking for a lot of things. And then one day I took my daughters out for ice cream. And we went there and I said, guys, we're only getting a small size scoop. My 8-year-old ordered vanilla and that was great. My 10-year-old threw a temper tantrum because a small size didn't meet her her goals. She wanted the largest ice cream possible. She said small wasn't fair. She wasn't fat. I could afford it. She wanted more. And it was a really embarrassing meltdown, but sort of the straw that broke the camel's back for me in terms of realizing that my kids didn't appreciate what we were giving them, and they had this sense of entitlement that, unfortunately, I think my husband and I had contributed to. So I thought about it for a day or two about how to sort of remedy this problem and took my kids aside after a couple days and said, I've thought about it. My oldest daughter had a meltdown in a restaurant over ice cream, so I said, we will not be eating out until... because it started in a restaurant, so no food for us until we gave food to 30 people that we didn't know and heard about their lives. Because I figured that by exposing my kids to people they had never met before, showing them sort of a broader view of the world and what other people go through, that they would develop a sense of tolerance and appreciation for other people and then learn to have more gratitude about their own lives. So it took 4 months, and we met 30 strangers, learned a ton, and my kids are more grateful.
Wow. And how did you make that happen? I mean, every parent could probably envision all the nightmares of that scenario.
Yeah. It was difficult, but I was determined. I mean, I could have easily said, guys, we're going to meet 30 people that we don't know and learn about them and then sort of let it just waft into the abyss and never happen. But I was determined to sort of revamp my kids' thinking about their own lives. So I took them to the grocery. We bought 30 blue gift bags. We filled them with non-perishable items that people could turn into a meal. And I said, well, we're going to start looking for people wherever we go. So one day after school, I said, hey, guys, you want to get your hair cut? They said, sure. I said, great. Go to the dining room table. Get one of those blue bags. We'll take you somewhere to get a haircut, but you need to learn the story of the woman who's cutting your hair. And my younger one said, yeah, I don't think I need a haircut after all. I said, oh, no, you're getting a haircut. And at that haircut, we met a woman who we'd never met before. She was working in the salon part-time. She was a divorced mother of three. Her three children, who at the time I think were like 12, 10, and 8, were home by themselves. I was there with my daughters. Her kids were home taking care of themselves because she was a single mom. It was her youngest daughter's birthday that day, and she was cutting my kid's hair on her youngest child's birthday. That right there, I think, really put life into perspective for my kids, because I said to them, that mom isn't with her kids on the most special day of one of their lives, their birthday. Have I ever missed your birthday? And they said, no. And we learned how this woman was making ends meet, even though it was hard. And from there, we everywhere we would go, we would look for somebody that we could talk to.
And how did it go? I mean, how did that experience of having to give food to people and hear their stories turn into a sense of gratitude in your daughters?
Right. So every person that we met, and we really met random people, so we didn't know what stories we were going to get. And we learned from this that every person has a story. My kids were able to look at other people's lives and sort of reflect back on their own and say, oh, wow, that person's going through XYZ. I'm also going through ABC. It may not be the same, but it's hard. They're making it. I can make it. They're doing a lot with, you know, whatever they're missing in their lives. I can do a lot with whatever I'm missing. You know, this person is taking a bad situation and making good of it. I can do the same. Plus, they realized that they had it a lot better than a lot of the people that we were meeting. This was not to show my kids, hey, look at all the people who have nothing and you have everything. This was not what that was. This was to say, hey, lots of people, even people who might have everything. I mean, not everyone that we met was poor, you know, indigent. We met people who had money, but yet they still had a story. They still had struggles. Everyone has struggles. And my kids realized I should be grateful for whatever struggles I have because I'm able to deal with what I've been given in my life. And my parents are able to give me a lot. So they were able to really use other people's lives to put their own in perspective. And it was great.
Right. It's an interesting experiment in yeah. terms of focusing on that way. I mean, a lot of what your daughters experienced, correct me if I'm wrong here, John Battaglia, maybe just what's prescribed as a decent human endeavor in a by a religious tradition or by other ways of slicing it, no?
Well, I think absolutely. I think serving. Anytime you give of yourself, there's generosity there, and being other-centered always leads to happiness and joy because when you share yourself, it adds value that when you're focused on yourself, you really turn inward after a while. You focus on yourself, you become someone who is entitled and begins to approach life in that way in whatever context that they find themselves in. So if not guided and refocused on what is most important, they can lose sight of that. And I think it's one of the roles of parents in early childhood development, those environments, to help them see beyond themselves, to see opportunities, and to realize all that they have. And I have done that with our children, and I take my daughter overseas, who travel internationally, and help her to see the world from this wide global perspective and the needs. We do a lot of work with children and the needs there, and they don't have food, and we provide food for them and have fun with them and laugh with them. And what's interesting to me is they really have very little, and yet they're smiling, they're joyful, they're having fun, they're engaged. And then you come back to the U.S., and that's where your culture shock comes in more than going overseas in these more remote areas. And we have a lot. No matter who you are in the States, you have much more than people in some of the remote areas internationally, like the Philippines or in Africa and Ghana, Africa, where we go often in. And because of that, sometimes we lose sight of all that we have. And you're not going to lose sight when your child has experienced all of this. It really gives them a whole different breadth of understanding.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the impact of giving thanks and expressing gratitude. Joining me in the studio are Robert Johnson, a professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, John Battaglia, the lead pastor of the Christian Chapel Church in Columbia, and Sharon Dunsky, Vermont, who conducted a four-month gratitude experiment with her family. For those of you in our audience, if you're a parent, how do you go about instilling a sense of gratitude in your kids? Or how or what did your parents do to instill a sense of gratitude in you? Share your experience. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Robert Johnson,
You come at this from a philosophical standpoint. Philosophically, why does gratitude matter?
Well, there are a number of reasons it matters for philosophers. But I wanted to go back to both of your experiences to just to note that there's a philosophical tradition going back at least to a man named Bishop Butler, who says that the best way to have a fulfilled life is not to focus on having a fulfilled life for yourself. It's to focus on other people and their needs, because when you focus on yourself and worry about whether you're happy or not, you're inevitably going to fail. And he called this the paradox of hedonism, that it's paradoxical that this great thing, being happy, is something that you shouldn't aim at for yourself, because it'll just make you miserable, mm-hmm. aiming at your own happiness. And it was reiterated by John Stuart Mill later on. He said basically people are unhappy mainly because of they're too focused on themselves was one of the reasons. You know, when people have a lot and they're unhappy, they haven't looked outside of themselves, because once you start taking pleasure in sharing and looking after other people's happiness, then there's endless amounts of happiness to be had. There's endless amounts of satisfaction to be gained simply by pursuing it, because there's endless need in the world. I just wanted to point out that actually philosophers have taken, you know, some of the things that you've been saying fit very well with a lot of what at least some philosophers think about gratitude and its value. Mm-hmm. And it does have to do with taking the focus off yourself and putting it back onto other people. And but philosophers are more interested in puzzles often, you know, philosophical problems with these sorts of things like gratitude. For instance, Nietzsche thought that famous philosopher, German philosopher, was somewhat critical of gratitude, because he thought being a benefactor to someone puts you in a position of power with regard to that person, and it indebts the person that you give to. It gives them a debt of gratitude that they owe to you and can never fully discharge. And there's another puzzle is about gratitude, is how could gratitude be a good thing when you can never discharge your debt of gratitude? If somebody does something good for you, I mean, you say thank you, oh, thank you so much, how can I repay you? Well, you can't pay them back, because then it's not a gift, right? You're rejecting the gift. So there's never a time in the future where you can say, well, I'm no longer grateful. You're always grateful. Right. You're always going to be grateful for any small thing done.
And isn't it that sort of debt of gratitude sounds harsh, but isn't it that sense of a sense of gratitude that drives a lot of Christian theology? I mean, the idea of being thankful to God and thankful for Jesus and a lot of those things that keep that theology rolling in a way.
Absolutely. I would say not really in an obligatory way. It's more of a voluntary response. I mean, as it relates to God himself, there's this grace, the charis in the original language of Greek, and this grace is offered to us. It's undeserved or undeserved kindness, as you might look at gratitude. And when you receive that, it changes your life, because it's pure. It's not asking for anything in return, but it draws you in, that you have a response. And as it relates to God, you have a response to serve him and lead him and to appreciate him. So it's a constant phrase on your tongue. Thank you, Lord. I'm grateful for all that you've done. And again, not focusing on all you haven't done, you know, but thank you for all that you have done. So there's a grace that comes to you that's undeserved. And when you take that and you're outward, then you offer that to others. We can't give what we don't have. And I think that the whole debt concept that you were talking about, I think there's an element of that, you know, that's true. Because when someone does something for you, you want to respond. It's the natural response to say thank you. if something impedes the thank you, then there's something going on beneath the surface that a person is struggling with. Nietzsche, his philosophy as he approaches that, I would suggest that the reason he struggles with that is because he's actually focusing on himself. And while he's saying, you know, you can never repay and you're always in a debt bondage, so on and so forth, is because he's reverting back to himself and how he feels, and perhaps the restriction that he might, you know, encounter himself. Is that something that you would affirm, or would you challenge?
Well, I think the reason Nietzsche wasn't all against gratitude, he thought there was healthy and unhealthy gratitude. Healthy gratitude is the sort of thing you might encounter saying, you know, I'm grateful it didn't rain today, and right. I'm grateful that I, you know, didn't have to get up early. I'm grateful that that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's gratitude that something's the case. Right. He thought that was healthy. That's good. Okay. Gratitude to someone, though, he thought that was a specific – it was specifically tied to the Christian tradition, I think, mm-hmm. and tied to the story of Jesus's, you know, paying the penalty for mm-hmm. Man's misdeeds mm-hmm. and thus plunging the entire human race into an unfulfillable – mm-hmm. It's impossible to repay debt, and his criticism was that it would have been better if Jesus had taken on the guilt, not the penalty, but the guilt, because we're left with the guilt.
But he actually did. So, you know, Nietzsche, who I think is the one who claimed that God is dead, and he actually did take on the guilt and our shame. And all of our, what I like to call baggage, you know, and stuff that every one of us has. And in going to the cross to sacrifice himself, he did that on behalf of humanity. Therefore, he gave himself as a ransom for us. He literally took our place. That's sacrifice. That's other-centered. That's unconditional love. And what Nietzsche is saying is that we're forever indebted. He's absolutely right. We are forever indebted to the work of Christ for salvation that we have, and we could never, ever get there. So therefore, we need a Savior. If we can get there on our own, we wouldn't need God. And I'm wondering, and you might know this better than I, if Nietzsche was suggesting such that we don't need God because he actually puts us in a, I'll use my word, debt bondage that can't be repaid, as opposed to living outside that sector and having a little more freedom.
I'm
not putting you on the spot. I'm actually trying to learn for you on that. Yeah.
I'm not an expert on Nietzsche. Yeah. I do... I'm familiar with some of his
sure.
views,
sure.
And it's just interesting that he gives a kind of history of, or yeah. what he thinks of as a history yeah. or an explanation
sure.
for the kind of gratitude that he thinks is part of mm-hmm. Western cultures, and it is this sort of gratitude to someone for doing mm-hmm. something, you know, and there's a kind of debt relation. I think he thinks is there. And he likes gratitude that, you know, gratitude that I've been – even you can feel that toward anybody. Mm-hmm. If they do something for you, you can be grateful that they did it without being
– Let me jump in real fast, and then Sharon will give you a chance to weigh in as well. And I just want to remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about gratitude and what being thankful means in our modern world today. Joining me in the studio are John Battaglia, the lead pastor of the Christian Chapel Church in Columbia, Robert Johnson, professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, and Sharon Dunsky, Vermont, who conducted a 4-month gratitude experiment with her own family. For those of you in the audience, what are you grateful for? We'd like to hear your story. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can send us an email as well. Our email address, intersection@kbia.org. You can also call in with questions for our panelists if you'd like to do that. Again, the number, 573-882-8925. Sharon, your thoughts.
Right. So one of the things that has been said is that, you know, there's this whole, what did you say, debt bondage, or, you know, you owe somebody a lot of thanks if they do something that you should be grateful for. And one of the things that I really stressed to my children was, you know, by meeting all these strangers that we were talking to and giving food to and learning from, they were helping us and we were helping them, that we should feel a feeling of appreciation towards them and gratitude that they're willing to talk to us and share their lives with us, but that it's really not important if they feel the same. We feel like we're doing something good by talking to them and letting and learning about them. But that when you do something good for someone, yes, it's nice if they appreciate it, but that's not what's really important. What's really important is that you are trying to repair the world, that you are trying to help other people, that you feel good about it, and that you keep doing it regardless of the thanks that you get. Because it's not about getting the thanks from somebody, at least in my mind. It's about doing your part to help improve the world and to learn about your neighbors and to better the community.
Right. And that repair the world idea is a big piece of Jewish theology, right?
It is, which I actually am Jewish. And there is a there's a saying, it's tikkun olam, which is Hebrew for repairing the world. And while I did not undertake this in any way as a religious project, I did sort of with my kids tie it back into, remember what you've learned in Sunday school about tikkun olam, repairing the world. You're doing a piece of that by improving your outlook on yourself and by meeting all these people and giving them food and, you know, developing a sense of tolerance and a sense of acceptance for other people. I mean, I introduced my kids to a lot of really tough subjects in this gratitude experiment that we did. The experiment being, could I change my kids into more grateful human beings? The answer being, yes, I could. Along the way, I mean, we met a couple that it was in a lesbian relationship, and one of the women in this relationship had actually had a baby and given her baby up for adoption and then realized that she was a lesbian. Her partner talked to us about how her family really almost disowned her after she came out as being a lesbian. We met someone who had gone through alcohol and drug abuse and had then joined the military sort of as his way of trying to clean himself up. We met someone who had been a Holocaust survivor, a family who had gone through the Bosnian War and seen all sorts of just horrific things happening to their friends and their family and their loved ones. So I introduced my children at the ages of 8 and 10, which is quite young, to a variety of really difficult topics because I wanted them to see that there's so much more than their little suburban life in Chesterfield. And I knew that if they had a lot of questions about these topics, that I would answer them in a way that I felt was appropriate for my children. And I told my kids, you may or may not agree with what you're hearing, and that's okay. We don't have to agree with everything. I mean, do I agree that using drugs is good? Absolutely not, although this young man that we had met had obviously cleaned himself up, which we think is wonderful. But I said, you may not agree with the lifestyles these people are living or with their choices or, you know, with some of the things they say, but that's not the important part. The important part is to tolerate and understand and accept them for who they are, because if you're constantly going around saying, I'm glad I'm not fill in the blank, Jewish, Christian, black, a woman, a lesbian, whatever you have, if you're constantly saying, I'm glad I'm not such and such, you can't have real gratitude. But if you can go around saying, you know, this world is full of different people. I may not agree with everything everyone does, but we all make up the world, and let's agree to have tolerance and acceptance to coexist. Then I think you can feel better about yourself because you're not always saying, I'm glad I'm not. And you can feel more grateful. And so learning all these lessons at an early age really did that for my kids. They're very accepting people now. And they'll say to me, I don't agree with what so-and-so said. But they have the right to express that as long as they're not, you know, going about it in the wrong way. And that was a really hard lesson for my kids to learn at a really hard age and a lesson that many of us as adults still haven't learned.
It's interesting. It's almost a tolerance project.
It was both. I didn't mean for it to be both. I meant for it to be gratitude. Look with what life you have and appreciate it. But tolerance became a theme, and so my children learned so much more than I could have ever imagined at the beginning.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I would completely concur with what you're saying. And the outcomes, the process, the lead, even though you weren't sure of all the outcomes, you had an intentional goal maybe here, and it brought in a wider scope.
Absolutely.
Everybody has a story.
They do.
And when we kind of look at people, realizing we all have stories, we've all been at different places, we're all at a different place.
Absolutely.
It really changes the perspective again that we're not the only one with a story.
Mm-hmm.
And our ear is open to hear your story.
Right.
And not because what can I get out of your story other than learning? I mean, what can I? And from that, I am a better person because I can give into other people's lives. I love the fact about your thought about be grateful, give to others without expecting a return.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom and happiness and fulfillment have this value at its foundation, even in relationships. If we have expectations, when they're not met, we have disappointments, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or depression or anger or bitterness. If we approach life and relationships without an expectation of what do I deserve or what can I get out of this, notwithstanding abuse and all sorts of, you know, violations to people, obviously, we're much better off for it. And I believe the world is much better off for it because we've contributed toward the repairing of the world, repairing of relationships and souls.
Yeah, although, I mean, as I said in the intro, the positive psychologist would say that part of what makes people feel happy is to look at what I am getting out of this, right? To take some time to reflect on that and actually feel gratitude for the things that are there as opposed to focusing completely on things that are not internal.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm grateful for my family. I'm grateful for my friends.
Right.
You know, I'm grateful for my congregation. I'm grateful for the Green Bay Packers being 10-0. I mean, you know, so there's nothing wrong with being grateful for what you have or in a relationship when someone does something, you know, for you to express that and say, I'm so glad that that happened. I'm not sure what we're saying has an opposite side of saying that can't be the case.
Right. And are there things that Sharon, your kids said they were grateful for after this experiment, like explicitly? Did they actually come out with a level of gratitude that was noticeable?
So, I mean, both of them now, more so than before, will say they're grateful for their sisters, you know, each other, which, you know, I figured at some point in their lives they would learn to be grateful for each other. But I think this really helps sort of speed that up. But it's not so much what they've said, although they have said some things, but more what they've done. Soon after we finished the experiment, my younger daughter was riding her scooter outside, left it on the front lawn, which, of course, we told her not to, and someone stole it, probably one of the neighbor kids. My older daughter was having a birthday. She called up her grandparents and said, don't buy me a birthday present this year. Buy a new scooter for my sister. That never would have happened before this project.
That's awesome.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about gratitude and what being thankful means in the modern world. We're going to take a short break here, but we hope you'll stick around and join us. You can give us a call as well, 573-882-8925, and share your gratitude with our audience. We'll see you in a minute. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about gratitude and what being thankful means in the modern world. Joining me in the studio are John Battaglia, the lead pastor of the Christian Chapel Church in Columbia, Robert Johnson, a professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, and Sharon Dunsky, Vermont, who conducted a four-month gratitude experiment with her two daughters. For those of you in our audience, how important are expressions of gratitude in your life? Share your experiences. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Now, we were talking over the break a little bit, glass half empty versus glass half full kind of orientation. And Sharon, you said that your daughters have definitely changed in that.
Absolutely. I mean, that was, I guess, one of my goals. And I actually sometimes didn't even use that term, glass half empty, glass half full, because I think we all know so many people in our lives who are glass half empty. And that's not a good way to be. How can you be happy if everything is always, oh, I need more, I need more? And I didn't want my kids to live the rest of their lives that way. And after meeting all these people, learning so many lessons, and really opening their eyes to the world around them, they definitely are much more glass half full now than glass half empty. And it's wonderful.
And they can resist the pressure, I guess, from their social group. I mean, because that's the thing that I notice with my kids is that kind of acquisitiveness that they can fall into occasionally comes from a kind of social pressure. You know, you have to have this next gadget, next thing.
Right.
And if I don't have it, I'm lacking. You know, I'm lacking something that I need.
Right. And so my younger daughter wanted this one particular gadget for a really long time, and we just kept saying, you don't need it. And let her use some of our gadgets. I said, we have gadgets you can use. You don't need it at school. You can use ours at home. And she got it. She stopped asking after a while. You know, do they still ask sometimes? Sure, not nearly as much as they did. And when we say no, they get it more because they say, you're right. You know, all these people we met were able to do without things, or they suffered much worse situations than anything that we've ever gone through, thank goodness. And they can see they really do see what's more important now.
Reminds me of this comedian. It was on YouTube that I saw it. It was very funny, though. He was talking about when finally got wireless on planes. And do you remember?
I didn't see this routine? But I like wireless on planes.
Wireless on planes. Well, he was on a flight, and you know, the guy sitting next to him, you know, he's working on his laptop, and the wireless goes down, and he goes, you know, he gets all upset, you know, that the wireless is down. And he said, look at you. You know, you're sitting in a chair 30,000 feet above the earth flying at hundreds of miles an hour, and you're frustrated because you don't have wireless.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing because the world has become so complex that there are so many little elements involved in everything we do that it's easy to forget all of those things, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you can't learn this when you're older. I'm confident you can, but it takes a little more intentionality. Sharon, what you created, the environment that you created for your children, not only set them up for success today, but it set them up for success long term. Because I'm thinking that when you're a child, okay, around your children's age and my boy's age, that as parents, we're creating environments of what's for them involuntary. Mm-hmm. For them, we're choosing. Mm-hmm. And they're reacting. Mm-hmm. As they begin to mature, they begin to choose.
Absolutely.
They begin to volunteer. And if we haven't equipped them in the context of gratitude, everybody has a story, maybe different than our story. That's okay. Mm-hmm. I want to give, not to get something in return, just because I want to think of others more than myself. Mm-hmm. As they get older, life is different. And I think they're more fulfilled. And we're not, I'll use me because I'm a guy, you know, we're not men, okay, who have little boys inside of us, because some of those, we'll say, gadget needs have been met. I think of, mm-hmm. you know, my kids, and you were just mentioning, I'll use Christmas, for instance, said, guys, what do you want for Christmas? Oh, I don't know, Mom, we have so much, you know, whatever you guys want to do. And I'm like, well, here's a magazine. Go pick something, you know. And my daughter, who's 17, she's a high school student at Rockbridge, you know, she says to us, you know, hey, for Christmas this year, I don't really want anything. Can we take the money that you would spend and can we use it on helping people around the world? And I'm thinking, where did these kids come from? You know?
You've done your job. Yeah. You've taught them well.
You know, so I think cultivating that
absolutely
when they're young gives them a much greater degree of a potential.
Right.
Now, again, as they get older, they have to make the choice to continue the values right. and the foundation that you've laid out.
Right. Well, and, you know, as you were just mentioning, Robert, you know, this man on the airplane who was all frustrated about the internet. So if he's doing that on an airplane, say he has young kids at home, he's home getting frustrated because the cable's out, because the mail didn't come, because Mizzou lost. Okay, we want Mizzou to win, but bad example. But he's getting frustrated over things that are probably really small in the scheme of life. And his kids are seeing this, and they're going to grow up and be the same way. I'm hoping that my kids are seeing me saying, you know what, so the cable's out, let's play game. You know, not, oh, the cable's out. I'm trying to, you know, demonstrate what I'm teaching them so that they will, you know, go on and when they get older, make those same choices, not be as frustrated about silly little things. And obviously, it sounds like you've done that very well with your kids.
Well, thank you. And what you were just saying, the word that popped in my mind was refocus.
Mm-hmm.
When they're kind of going a little off course, mom's refocusing. For instance, hey, let's play a game. And to the children, oh, that's great. They'd much rather play with mom than even be on the computer at this
Absolutely.
Age. So you're constantly helping them to refocus. And I just think that that point of deference equips them.
It does raise a question, though, Sharon. What did you have to do differently? I mean, your parenting, did it have to change? Did you have to change your own behavior and your own outlook?
I didn't have to change my own outlook because I've sort of been always very focused on helping other people, learning other people's stories. I mean, I'm the woman who's in the grocery line talking to the woman behind me and learning her sob story and feeling really bad. That's just sort of who I am. And I'm the person who's always, you know, donating to different food pantries and things like that. So I didn't have to change so much who I am. Maybe I did have to change some behaviors in terms of how we parent in that my husband and I realized we can't always say yes. And we weren't saying yes. You know, our kid would say, can I have that sweater? Oh, sure, it would look cute on you. But we were saying yes because we loved them. And then we realized that giving them what they asked, that sweater, that book, that whatever, is not showing love. It's just giving them something, and there's other ways to show love. So, you know, we had to, as you said, refocus and show them that quality time with the family is more important than going shopping. So, yeah, we have made some changes.
Right.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting. Another thing that I wanted to ask about, I mean, we've been talking about this sort of gratitude and a lot of the benefits that come with it. You feel better about yourself. You might sleep better. You're happier. I mean, all these things. There's still sort of, I mean, when we dial it up to a more philosophical or ethical standpoint, we're still thinking about it from a self-interested way. Like, if my kids are show more gratitude, their lives will be better because of X. And I wonder, Robert, for you, what are the other sort of justifications or reasons that gratitude would matter from a philosophical standpoint besides what somebody gets out of being grateful?
Yeah, well, let's hope it's not genuine gratitude if you're doing it for the sake of yourself and what you get out of the gratitude or even what your family gets out of the gratitude. Gratitude is given for its own – I mean, you give it for the sake of what's been given to you, and that makes it gratitude, I guess, is the point. But in terms of justifications of gratitude, are you thinking about arguments for why we should be
Yeah,
grateful?
I mean, why does it matter that anyone would be grateful from a philosophical or ethical or moral standpoint?
Well, there are a lot of different, as you can imagine, a lot of different answers to that question, competing answers. For someone who is a utilitarian or somebody like John Stuart Mill, somebody like that, gratitude is called for when it's to the benefit of the overall good. And so gratitude is a kind of behavior trait, perhaps set of actions, that is beneficial overall, in his view, I would have thought. And but there are other views about what's important about gratitude. It may be that it's the right response to someone's having valued you as a person. When somebody helps you out, they have, in a sense, shown that they value you, and the right response to that is gratitude, because that then returns the same valuing as a response to that person instead of just, you know, treating them as a mere means to whatever benefit you got from them. If you don't show gratitude, then they just they're just a source of goods for you, and they could have been a dispenser, a goods dispenser.
I mean, can you imagine what life would be like if nobody was grateful for anything and if all they cared about was getting everything for themselves and climbing up the ladder and bettering themselves and they didn't care about anyone else? I mean, that what? Then we wouldn't care about our children. We wouldn't care about, you know, even taking our kids to the doctor if they were sick, because why be grateful we even have kids? We're just out for ourselves. I think the world would be a really nasty place if people didn't care and people didn't appreciate.
Yeah, and I think, Robert, when you were speaking, I heard two things, the individual and the community-wide. And the individual of just the basic common courtesy of a thank you and please in relationship. And then the community aspect of it is for the common good. Think of the conspiracy of kindness and what will it look like if a community were all moving in the same direction would thank you and please and I appreciate that verbally or a written note. You go into the stores and you're greeted with welcome, you know, thank you. You have city leaders who are, you know, sending out a letter or doing things that are contributing to an expression and demonstration of thank you. And I'm not suggesting that ours, you know, doesn't. I'm speaking holistically. Kind of what I like to use the word of is a community of revolution, revolutionize the way we view people individually, the way we view our city, and what can we do if all the individuals have this view in mind and begin to live this out wherever they are, in whatever space they're at, they begin to express their thank yous verbally demonstrable acts.
And how would we do that? I mean, what ideas do you have about expanding this beyond just one family's experience into a community-wide level? I mean, what would that look like in terms of trying to get what you just described, John?
Well, I think paying attention to it is the first step. I mean, when you you don't want to ignore generosity, rather pay attention to it. When people are grateful, make something of it. And celebrate it, I guess, when it's appropriate. I mean, there's misplaced gratitude, too. I mean, we shouldn't forget that not all gratitude is a good thing, especially when you've got power relations that are extremely unequal. So, should you feel gratitude if you're, like, enslaved by somebody and they give you benefits? Well, maybe that's not the right response in certain cases or and that has to do with, you know, wider sorts of issues about what kinds of relationships there are in the community. If they're relationships of rough equality, then the kind of inequality that's implied by benefiting someone, like you're giving them some help and they need it, and so you're in a somewhat unequal position, is at the against the backdrop of a broader equality of persons. Mm-hmm. So you're just as everybody is on the same footing. And then gratitude, that's sort of a necessary condition for gratitude being in place, is that you've got some sort of rough equality. You can't have gross inequality and make sense of – you can. I mean, there are kinds of gratitude you can have when there's really super large inequality between people. But it's quite limited because of the inequality makes it hard to make sense of, I guess, under those circumstances.
Well, I've had a lot of parents, you know, ever since I did this experiment with my kids and I've talked about it to a variety of people, I've had a lot of parents come up to me and say, how can I teach my own kids to appreciate what they have? Now, do I expect every family in this country to meet 30 people they didn't know and talk about them? No, I think it would be wonderful if they would do it. That's not realistic. I mean, I think I was crazy enough to take on this project. I don't expect everyone else to as well. But I think that you can start small. Every family can start small. Introduce your kids at a young age to you know, to different charitable organizations. Take them to a food pantry. Have them tour the food pantry. Collect books and take them to, you know, an inner city school. Just little things, start small, to show your kids that there are people out there besides yourself that are deserving and that you can help, and think it helps them put the world into perspective.
I'm curious, did it happen automatically? Like if you take your kids to soup kitchens and, you know, this sort of thing, and all they need to do is just see that there are people who have less than mm-hmm. them. Did you have to do something extra besides just doing that to trigger the gratitude response?
No, I think that I just kept reinforcing this whole idea in my kids over and over. And I think that's the thing. I think if you take a child once to a soup kitchen, the point's lost. But if you take a child once to a soup kitchen and then you discuss it for a few days, and then a few weeks later you take them to an inner city school and bring books and you discuss it for a few days and you keep doing things and you make it sort of a part of who your family is, helping other people, learning about the world, you have to reinforce it over and over, and eventually it sort of becomes part of who you are and who they are.
And I think, Robert, to your question, Sharon's answered that, but you added something to it that I think is really important. Mm-hmm. The word you used was discussion. Mm-hmm. So critical thinking and reflection
Absolutely.
Is very important to the experience, especially when they're young, because it's not just what do you see. Okay, what did that mean?
Right.
What did you take away from that? So Absolutely. They're learning observable experiences, mm-hmm. maybe something that they were a little afraid of, something new, an aha moment. Mm-hmm. And as you coach them through that, it's what I would call your equipping. You're giving them tools and mm-hmm. you're giving them skills so that down the road, once again, they're prepared to initiate without mom's initiation, mm-hmm. it comes because they are equipped mm-hmm. for the common good of those in their own sphere of life.
And I mean, my kids and I discuss things all the time. I mean, our dinner table has very interesting conversation. You know, we talk about politics and religion and about, you know, things they heard on the news about, you know, different injustices and things like that. And after every, event where we would meet a new person for our experiment, on the way home, I would talk to my kids. And then the next day, I would talk to my kids. And I wouldn't get, you know, I would ask them, what did you learn from this? And I wouldn't let them get away with things like, oh, cancer's bad, or having no money's bad. No, we all know that having no money is bad, or having cancer is bad. But what else did you learn that you didn't know before? And I would push them, you know, until they learned, like, oh, well, we're really grateful that, you know, we're healthy. We're really grateful that we know doctors who can help us if we get sick. You know, things that they maybe hadn't thought about before. I would really push them to think, not just on the surface, what do you learn about this story, but really deeper, what have you learned? Right. Discussion's key.
Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the impact of giving thanks and expressing gratitude. Joining me in the studio are John Battaglia, the lead pastor of Christian Chapel Church in Columbia, Robert Johnson, professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, and Sharon Dunsky, Vermont, who conducted a four-month gratitude experiment with her two daughters and is working on a book about that. For those of you in our audience, what does giving thanks look like in your life? Share your story. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We have just a little time left, so please call in now if you want to join our conversation. Sharon, some parents might be inspired to try an experiment like yours. What advice would you give them if they were going to try to embark on something like this?
To not be afraid, to just go with it, and that people will not be afraid to talk to you. That was my biggest fear, was, wow, when I really approached these people, and we really did approach them like, you know, the random people in stores and things like that. So people were not expecting us to come up and talk to them. And I was afraid, what if they think we're weird? What if they call the police on us? What if they think that, you know, we have ulterior motives? But what I realized is two things. One, people love speaking about themselves, and they're willing to do it almost any time. And two, when people realize that you're coming at something from a really good place and that you have really good, pure intentions, they want to help you. And so that, you know, anybody who would want to do what we did and learn life lessons from random strangers, I would encourage you to do it, because connecting with somebody else is one of the most amazing things that you can do in life, and you will learn something from everyone you talk to. Another thing that I learned from this is, if you've ever been in a restaurant and your waitress is really rude and you go, oh, God, she was awful, I'm not leaving her a tip. Well, I learned from this experiment I did with the kids that maybe that waitress, you know, just lost her house. Maybe her boyfriend just beat her up. Maybe she just got robbed. Maybe something really bad happened in her life and that's why she's rude. And so now when I've been in a situation where a salesperson or a waitress or someone is rude, I go, wow, you seem like you're having a really hard day. Are you okay? And occasionally I've been blown off. I'm fine. But most of the time people say, wow, thanks for asking. No, I'm really not okay. And then they talk to me and that makes them feel better. Mm-hmm. And I feel more understanding about why they were rude in the first place.
Interesting. And John, in your line of work, I mean, a lot of this goes along with what a pastor would be doing too, trying to help teach a congregation some of these things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Sharon was talking about listening. You know, if we're talking all the time, we can't hear. So listening is important. Robert, you said paying attention. These are just basic things that anybody can do, but they're really important. For us as a congregation, we have something we call Second Saturday, which is our serve day. Not to say that we don't do it other days, but we're intentionally as a congregation partner with the nonprofits in the city. And we call them, say, do you need any help? Here's what we're doing. And they always say, we welcome that. And we'll schedule and 100, 155, you know, people from, you know, out of 600 people, we go down and we just serve for the day. And we help them and we bring our children. And they experience what you were saying, Sharon. And that creates a culture of gratitude, a culture of giving, a culture of sharing. And it's very beneficial to the atmosphere of how people think and feel within our congregation. We do not have walls in our church. I mean, we have physical walls, but we believe in doing church outside of the building, in the life of those inside of our community. And we really do believe in contributing to the common good. Not sure we always get there, but that's our goal. That's our desire to participate. Sometimes I have found churches are perceived as with their hands looking for a handout, you know, give something to us. You know, we're a church and we deserve a discount at the flea market, you know. Right. And our philosophy is, no, we're here to give to our community. Even if you don't give anything mm-hmm. back, that's not why we're doing mm-hmm. this. So we serve at the food bank. We're not expecting hot dogs back. Right. You know, we serve at the shelter or Big Brothers or Big Sisters or Love Inc. or Coyote Hill. All of these nonprofit organizations that are caring for people. We're not saying, you know, look at us, look at us. We're good people too. We're just doing it. We're just giving, and now we do. There's a benefit, but it's more a natural benefit that we're not trying to gain. It just happens right. Because people appreciate when you value them.
Okay, we have a caller on the line, Bob from Columbia. Are you with us, Bob?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for joining the program and for calling in today.
I have a question for all of you.
Okay.
Well, I was wondering, why is it important to be grateful, you know, courteous to people in this day and age?
Okay.
That's a really good question. Yeah. And I think in this day and age, it's even more important to try and be grateful and be courteous and get to know your neighbor and get to help in your community, because there's so many things that pull us away from interpersonal connections nowadays. I mean, if I wanted, I could sit on my computer and talk to people for hours and never have to have a face-to-face conversation. And so all this technology, I think, hinders, you know, interpersonal relationships. And so forcing yourself to actually meet people face-to-face and help them, I think, helps us sort of overcome the fact that technology is really pulling us away constantly.
And the pace.
The pace
of technology. I mean, it is just, everything is fast. The rapidity of change, it happens all around us. Mm-hmm. And if not intentional, we can just kind of be, you know, blown in the wind by it. There needs to be an effort. There needs to be what I like to call what's the word? I'm looking for a particular word I can't capture right now. But to literally take the energy to say thank you and to say I appreciate that as opposed to think it. Mm-hmm. So well, I might say I'm thinking, Robert, thank you for what you did. But, Robert, you don't know I'm thinking it. But when I say thank you, now I've communicated to you something of value.
Yeah, I was going to say also I think it's important that our relations express an attitude of valuing others, that we value others as persons and not mere sources of benefits for ourselves. And that's what gratitude does, is it maintains a sense that these other people are valuable persons. And when you acknowledge that their help or you acknowledge the benefit that you've gotten, express a kind of respect for them as persons.
Right. Bob, did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did.
Okay, well, thanks again for calling in, for joining the program today.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to share a story from the chat room. Paula in the chat room says that sometimes we teach our kids ingratitude unintentionally, and this is a story from the mid-1960s. She said her four-year-old saw a picture in a magazine of what he really wanted for Christmas, a Fisher-Price circus, she says, and that the five-year-old brother wanted trucks, games, books, a wide variety of toys. On Christmas morning, Mr. Four-Year-Old looked under the Christmas tree, his eyes lit up, and he said, oh, look, I wanted a Fisher-Price circus, and Santa brought it. Brother wanted a whole lot of things, and Santa brought them. And then Paula says, I had to convince him that there was a whole set of things for him too, not just the circus, right? That sometimes we may unintentionally create these situations where kids don't recognize all the things that they have.
Right, right. I think that's true. And I think, you know, to keep reminding your children that everything they do have is important and that they are lucky to have it, but to help them not want more than what they have, to be satisfied with what's in front of them and not constantly wanting something outside.
Right.
So there's nothing wrong with having things, you know, as long as the things don't have you. And so when you give gifts to your children or meet their needs, that's not a bad thing.
No.
As long as it's, you know, it's in a context of gratitude and appreciation and recognition. Not everybody has this, and you're not entitled to this. So we as a family share in this because we love each other. Matter of fact, I think if we mistakenly deprive our kids, thinking that we're helping them by withholding certain things from them, I think it's actually a hindrance and a hurt to them. Meeting the needs of the children, genuine needs, are it's right. It's actually setting them up for self-esteem and being healthy and understanding. It's when you withhold things that are core to need that they begin to clamor for stuff because inside that need hasn't been met.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've got to stop there. That's all the time that we have today. I'd like to thank our guests, Sharon Dunsky, Vermont, John Battaglia, and Robert Johnson for joining us in the studio today. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program. You can also submit your questions and comments and chat with others in the audience via our online chat room. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. A big thank you today to our entire team. The show is produced by Raymond Tungekar and Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Karen Stockman. Pat Akers, our audio producer. Executive producers Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.